outlooks, as well as those features that were variable. He found only two features which were common to all religions. First, the recognition of a wrongness in the world. Second, the offering of a solution for that wrongness. For Clinton was the curing of the subject. In the case of Sri Shankara Acharya, the problem appeared as one of ignorance. Not ignorance in the ordinary sense, but spiritual ignorance. And the resolution was through the attainment of knowledge in the sense of nama. In fact, this knowledge was not a means to liberation, but was viewed as liberation itself. And in the Christian world, wrongness is presented as the presence of a hostile or derelict will which leads man to do that which he knows he should not do. And the problem becomes one of domestication of a adverse will. The problems thus appear various, but there is agreement in the fact that there is a wrongness in this world, something that needs correction, that in some way the mankind of this world has gotten off the track of what it should be. The problem is one of correction. But another thing that a distinction that William James often made was there's a difference between knowledge about and acquaintance with. Now, I shall not today deal much with knowledge about, for you can get that from the books. There are many sources. It's good. But remember, concerning all knowledge about, that the rule which Buddha laid down applies. You can only say, if you know of this knowledge, thus I have heard, or thus I have read. You cannot say, I know. It's only through acquaintance with that you can say, thus I know. And when one has something to offer that is of the nature of acquaintance with, it's far more important than any amount of knowledge about. I have certain acquaintance with. Of this I shall speak. He who reads in this field comes across a word used a great deal by Aurobindo and the others who have pioneered the way, and a word which I use also, namely realization. And I propose to speak somewhat of the significance of realization, what it may mean, what its value is. First off, realization is the way to acquaintance with, as distinct from, knowledge about. The problem may appear to different people in different forms. The form of realization may be quite various. I shall speak, however, of a particular form and a particular approach. The problem came to me in a very special way, right down the path of Western philosophy. I used to be a lover of the rationalistic school of philosophy, that which was founded by Descartes, developed by Spinoza, Leibniz, and came to seed in the hands of Christian Wolff. Then there was another school that ran parallel to this in England, in the British Isles, which is a school of skepticism. Brought up the question of how far we can trust our knowledge. And it eventuated in a position proclaimed by David Hume, which in effect was, there wasn't anything that we really knew. Even though we experienced the sun rising a million times, we could not know that it would rise tomorrow. That was the death of hope. And that awakened another, the greatest of all our philosophers, from what he called his dogmatic slumber, Immanuel Kant. And led to 12 years of thought, which is written up in 5 months as a critique of pure reason. The question was, how far can we trust our knowledge? The knowledge with which we are all commonly familiar is knowledge through sensation and conceptual knowledge. That is the sole concern of the secular philosophers and psychologists. I will not go into any length on this, but the conclusion reached by Immanuel Kant was this, and this seems to stand. That our conceptual knowledge gives us only possibility. And in order to give existence to the possibility, in the ordinary case, it must be supported by sensuous knowledge or experience. Thus, there's an important difference between $100, the idea of $100 in my pocket, and the having of an actual $100. I can predicate everything that may be predicated of the real $100, also of the idea of $100. But there's one thing that the idea of $100 doesn't have, and that is existence. There must be added the sensuous cognition of an actually felt and seen 100 dollars before I can predicate existence of it. Now that happens to have been an example of the logical process by which Immanuel Kant destroyed what is known as the ontological argument for God. The ontological argument for God ran roughly in this way. I have an idea of an absolutely absolute being. And therefore, since I'm able to have the idea, the being must be. Now, argument carried a lot of weight at one time. And here, Kant slew it. Hegel was a bit disgusted, he says, to put the conception of God on the same level as $100. But the logic was just as valid with respect to the ontological argument for God as for the argument that an idea of $100 is not the same as a real $100. Well, despite the fact that Kant left this very convincingly, without any means of knowing metaphysical truth through the action of conceptual cognition and sensuous perception, nonetheless being a very religious man, he tried to offer some hope of how we should be able to know certain metaphysical truths that are very important to human beings. He listed three: the reality of God, immortality, and freedom. His offering here was not too convincing. It dawned upon me back in Harvard days that perhaps the problem was that there is the non-action of a latent function of cognition. That could be awakened. In other words, that when we reduce cognition to conceptual cognition and sense perception, we do not have the whole of cognition. If there is some third organ or function or faculty, whatever you want to call it, that might open the door to the transcendent, that could perhaps answer these metaphysical questions. That was the basis of a search that took 24 years, involving study, involving trying to formulate the problem, groping a great deal of it, and ultimately reached this conclusion, that there was nothing to be attained. I'll give you the logic of that in a moment. And that all, from that moment, I stopped searching, since nothing was to be attained. And that was the key to the door opening into the realm that made all the difference in the world. more than once. It was the key to attainment. Now notice the paradox. The realization that there is nothing to be attained became the key to attainment. You've got to get used to these apparent contradictions. For we're dealing with a zone that cannot be translated into dualistic consciousness without the use of paradox. On the other hand, you've got to guard against the complete chaos of thought, which you would arrive at if you thought there were no order in things. There is an order, as well as the fact that a transcendent truth, when projected into the dualistic order, requires paradoxical statement. And one of the tasks is the resolution of such paradoxes. Usually it means that one, in one sense, so-and-so is the case, and in another sense, the negation of that is the case. Thus, the Buddhist will say, as for instance the sixth patriarch, that we, nay, all creatures, are already Buddha. And yet, there is a sense in which Buddhahood is attained. That one I hope to resolve before this hour is over. That one is very, very important indeed. But you can see that if one grasps the sense in which we all, together with all creatures, whether human or subhuman or superhuman, are Buddha already, then there is a sense in which Buddhahood cannot be attained, because you cannot attain that which you already are. But there's another sense in which it is attained, and very few yet have attained it. My approach, as you will see, was a rather technical one. Is there an organ of knowledge that will resolve the problem left to us by Immanuel Kant? Immanuel Kant proved to be the bridge from the Western mind, with me at least, over to the mind of Sri Shankar Acharya, who himself was a master of criticism, and combined with it a capacity for presenting actual metaphysical truth without violating the canons which were recognized by Immanuel Kant. The result is, I might call my path the epistemologic subdivision of the yoga of knowledge. I don't think many have gone that particular way. I found it enabled me to answer questions that I rarely have ever asked, and did not enable me to ask the questions that are most common. Now, the questions that are most common seem to deal with some very mundane matters, as how can I get well, problems of sickness, how can I get healthy, all that. And this didn't tell me how to answer those questions at all. I dealt with the problem of personal, of the vital nature and so forth, rather trenchantly. The best way, it seemed to me, to handle the question of health was to be well. But most people don't care for that. But think, what a lot of fun is lost if you were completely well. The fun of being sick. And especially the fun of talking about it. I don't know if people would lose their main object, subject of conversation. They couldn't talk about their operations or so on. They really love you when it comes to the showdown. If they would take the attitude, and this is what I'd say on the question of health, be ashamed of yourself every time that you get sick. Put it down as a bad mark against you. Bad score. You failed. You didn't do what you could have done. Don't be sympathetic with yourself and reject all sympathy for somebody else. That's my offering on the subject of bodily health. I think it would get rid of more than 50% of the illness that's around. The only drawback is it would be kind of hard on the doctors. Now, as I found it, and this follows the pattern laid down by Shankara, that a transformation in consciousness is induced, in which there is a shift from one self-center to another, and an inversion in consciousness. We might say that the shift is from the ego as being myself to the true self. Perhaps in the sense Jung uses it, but better still in the sense of the Atma as the center of your consciousness. Now, this is a Copernican change. To draw a figure from the history of astronomy. Just shifting your base of reference makes all the difference in the world. When you say, I and me, this personal ego, Jung calls the center of relative consciousness, there are many things that many problems arise. And many of those problems are of such a nature that from that premise, that base, you cannot answer them. And if the shift is made to a new base, a new center, which you call the true self or the Atman, many of the problems that have been just simply disappear. And if there are problems which remain, you're in a position to deal with them more effectively. It is a familiar experience of those who've been students of mathematics that simply a shift of base can be the key to the resolution of a difficult problem. In the history of astronomy, the old view was that this world is the center of the universe. It is known as the Ptolemaic system of astronomy. But if you then proceeded to calculate or picture the paths of the stellar bodies, you got into an enormous mass of complexities. Since the sun, all the planets and the moon were going around the Earth, and even the stars were going around the Earth. The actual observation showed that they didn't go in circles. So you had to build up elaborate cycloids and epicycloids movements. Others are epicycloids. You've got very complex movements. Now, mathematically, those movements are valid and correct from the standpoint of take step of a system of coordinates that's fixed with respect to the Earth. That is valid. But just so soon as the center was shifted from the Earth to the Sun, and the Earth was conceived as going around the Sun and the other planets, dealing only with the solar system for the moment, then there was a great simplification. The paths of the sidereal bodies became roughly circular or elliptic, or in general took the form of conic sections, which are relatively simple curves. Mathematics became very simple in handling them. Many problems then that was well nigh impossible before became resolvable at this moment. Well, I might liken the shift that comes in the yoga of knowledge through self-analysis as to such a Copernican shift from the ego as center to the Atman as center, and that your system of coordinates is established there and your worldview is oriented from that position. Well, this implies, however, what we call a fundamental realization. A fundamental realization is to be contrasted by fragmentary, premonitory realizations, which many people have had. But a fragmentary or premonitory realization does not lead to the change in your base of reference. It gives you the comfort of knowing there is a beyond, that there is a something to be attained, given really for the reason to keep up your courage and to go on. But you revert back to the old position of identifying yourself with the ego. And it is not enough. It becomes a fundamental realization when, from that moment forth, you know yourself to be the Atman. For the moment. Whereas there are many egos, only in a certain subtle apparent sense can you ever speak of many Atmans. The figure often used is that of the sun that may be seen reflected in a dewdrop. That is the individual Atman. But the sun that's reflected in the dewdrop is one with the sun in the sky. Thus also, the apparently individual Atman is identical with Paramatman. There is, thus, in the last analysis, but one self. And the multitude of us who seem to reflect that self and do, more or less consciously, are, after all, part and parcel with this indivisible unity of the Paramatma. One moving in that extended state of experience may have this feeling that he's absolutely identical with every human being, with every creature that was. And a very humorous question came into my mind one time. How do I know that I'll go back and find myself in the same body? I might be in any other body for that matter. You do well. And somehow or other, I happen to wake up and come back in this one. And I'm not quite sure why. Because the sense of being present in all, was so strong. Now this is a realization that in principle could be attained by self-induced effort and self-devised means without the aid of a guru. Though in general, it does require the aid of a guru. It is, however, in principle possible. I wish, however, to direct your attention to something a good deal more profound than what I've spoken about, where it would be quite impossible by self-induced effort and self-devised means to attain. One, merit does not count. There can only be the induction of the state by him who has it already. And I'm going, this will take us on to a stage beyond that of the Copernican shift from the world as a center of the universe to the sun, to the systems of coordinates that are used today by the astronomers for the larger problem of the great systems beyond our galaxies. In that case, they use the Milky Way, the plane of the Milky Way, as the base of their coordinates. And now notice very particularly, it's not now a center like the sun, but something more abstract, the plane of the Milky Way. And that's precisely what we'll be getting into. What I've said so far will give you the essence of the realization of Shankara that there are deeps beyond Shankara. One, I was impressed. I've been following the discipline of the voice of the silence. I had been impressed with its instruction that beyond the way to nirvana, there was a greater way, the way to the renunciation of nirvana, until such day as all creatures shall be taken in. The formula for this is given as in the words of Kuan Yin, never will I seek nor receive private individual salvation. Never will I enter into final peace alone, but forever and everywhere will I strive for the redemption of all creatures throughout the world. It seems to a philosopher, as well as to those of sympathetic heart, that the release of one unit is not enough. That I am not wholly free while these bound remain travailing, indeed, parts of myself. Well, seemed like turning down a wonderful state of consciousness. That's for a million years. I don't know how long. It seemed a little depressing, too. But 33 days, and I was told to watch for their cycle 33, after that 7th of August, 1936. Something walked in on me, an order that Nirvana walked in on me. Something very strange. First there was a sense of enormous satisfaction. In every possible direction, which gradually transformed into a state of indifference, which has a meaning similar to our Benzo's equality of attitude in all directions, no preferences anywhere, no preference even between transcendental bliss and pain. One could enter, as it were, with equal attitude into a hell world as well as into a highly transcendent domain far above the heavens that can be ordinarily imagined. This was a strange sort of consciousness. It was not colored by a quality of great delight. I had known states that had been colored by a quality of such great delight that you could, that the organism couldn't take it. You had to hold it down, gentle it. This organism, there's a portion of these delights. The amount that these physical organisms can take is only a tiny fraction. Otherwise, they feel overloaded, strained. And there's some evidence that they need to be burned out. But he was a state, and he was superior. But I saw a delight below me. Nirvana there, some cloud in here. It changed my whole philosophy. I already had the philosophy of Shanta. I accepted it on intellectual grounds. First realization did not lead to any change of that. Then true, as Luba maintained, that the philosophy I brought out was the same as the philosophy I took into this state, not this case. The whole conception of the relationship of samsara and nirvana. Samsara is the universe of objects and so forth. Nirvana is the state of quiescence, unimaginable, withdrawn. I saw them as supplementary, as one implying the other, but they were, neither one was self-existent by itself. They were the great pair of opposites. And this state of the high indifference was actually the integration of inconceivable bliss with also equally inconceivable pain. Doesn't mean you feel that, even as pain either, but it is the relative consciousness. Well, I never heard of such thing in literature anywhere. And I had to write with the best language I could use at the time to explain. It was only later, and in fact, in one part, only within the last 2 or 3 months, I've recognized from writing that points to the same consciousness. Surveyed is very rare. At that time, the Tibetan books that were edited by Evans Wentz had not been published, or at least I had not. No, I hadn't contacted them. Some of them were published. And also the Buddhist Bible that came out under the Dr. Goddard. Had not yet seen. I don't think it was published. There were some things in there that made a correlation. Now, there was a deeper stage, went in 3 stages before the relative consciousness that was acting as a witness and recording was unable to follow any further. At this point, there was a disappearance of the self, a disappearance of the divinity, and their absorption into something still more ultimate, which I call the eternal. And at that point, I knew what Buddha meant. taught the doctrine of Anatman and Nastikata. The self and the divinity are valid up to a point, but they inhere in and are derived from something more ultimate. The statement of Buddha, or the realization of Buddha, is known to me as more profound than that of Shankara. And what is this consciousness? All pairs of opposites were united. Here, for our conceptual consciousness, we know through contrast. We know north by its contrast with south. We know up by its contrast with down. We know good by its contrast with evil. Let me interject at this point. There is no such thing as an entity entering this plane who can be predicated as only good. For he also has the shadow that is essentially a part of him. The total reality of Christ is Christ's saint. Only to find the right relationship, the domestication of the satanic power, not the destruction of it, for that is impossible. Order. That is the achievement, and that's what Christ accomplished in the temptation. Get thee behind me, Satan. Not destroying, driving the satanic power into non-existence, but get thee behind me, and makes of him not merely of Christ, not merely a lovely but ineffective ideal, but an actually effective power for the domesticated evil. It's transformed from its evilness into the principle of power, potency. A three-dimensional actuality, if you please, rather than a two-dimensional ideal that's ineffective. These are deep things, and they are painful things. They may be painful for you, because we like to see good as all good. Can't get it that way in this dualistic world. There is a shadow always where there is a light. Just get started. I've come to the crucial word. What is this I am different? This consciousness, which I call consciousness without an object and without a subject. Here is a conception hard to grasp, because ordinarily we think of consciousness as a function of a being. Now you must think, to grasp this, of consciousness as being self-existent, or original, and constitutive of all things, and that the being who knows and the object that is known is derivative from that. This is not then consciousness in the ordinary sense of the word. It's extending it to a meaning beyond its ordinary sense. It's approaching the universal unconsciousness from the positive standpoint of being conscious. Now, in that state of no objects, where it's the pure consciousness, the universal container of all that is, and from which all things are derived, and where everything whatsoever eternally abides, so that you know there is no such thing as suffering anywhere, but only the imagined suffering of one wink of sleep, of that, if you please. But none can be destroyed, none can be lost, so that even the office of compassion seems meaningless. But there was also something else there, and there was the power to be conscious of that. Consciousness. Ordinarily, we are not conscious unless we have objects before us. Objects may be ideas, to be sure, but some content there. But consciousness can be so subtleized that it can be conscious of consciousness without content. Right, I found on page 96 of the first edition of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, in a footnote, a reference to just this sort of thing. There is that which they call Rigpa, which is this pure, supermundane consciousness, which you might call a substantive consciousness, because it is that of which all things are composed. And then a second consciousness, Shesri, which is the cognitive function of consciousness, and which when combined with Rigpa becomes the Dharmakaya. That's only in the last 2 months I found that correlation. And it also made clear what I'm dealing with in the high indifference. And there's a Dharmakaya consciousness, and I've proved that despite the texts, you can return and be in this world. And that's what I'm saying that is new. For the literature that I've seen always says that either that or Nirmanakaya, but not both. And I found that it is possible. It may have happened very rarely, but if it happens once, it's proven possible. Possible to know the Dharmakaya consciousness, to know that you abide in it eternally and function here in the world of relativity at the same time. I took this occasion to put forth this rather radical idea, based upon a realization. For in it is the seed of a new religious orientation in which suffering is transcendent. Sacrifice and renunciation are no more. But it is possible to abide in the highest and function here, knowing no pain, no deed, with those who imagine they are suffering. And that will have to bring this to a close. I will conduct meditation later. That bears right on this consciousness of which I have been speaking.